economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Friends, clients, adversaries, family members, and the occasional stray reactionary who tunes into us by mistake. It's Jack Tuckner and Deborah Orell with the Women's Rights in the Workplace show on Gary Knowles, PRN.FM. We hope everybody is doing well today. How are you doing, Deborah Orell? Good to see
you. Fantastic.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear. It's, you know, as precarious and warm and challenging as it is in the world out there, today we're going to try to bring a little bit of certainty into our program today because we're really excited. We have a prominent and eminent guest named George Zelma. And before I get into introducing you, and we're going to spend the bulk of this hour talking about the value that George adds to the world, actually, in the work that he does as a progressive attorney who champions the rights mostly of children who are, the word is disabled, but, you know, or less than fully able-bodied, who require some additional help and accommodation from the school systems to be fully, to become fully themselves and fully productive. But before I do, I just wanted to mention a little update. Since the last time we spoke about pregnancy discrimination and the EEOC, the EEOC, and since in the last 2 weeks ago, issued an updated enforcement guidance on pregnancy discrimination, which is exactly what happened. Remember, we talked, Deborah, in New York with the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act.
Yes.
And so, long story short about the EEOC guidance, federal law, even the Pregnancy Discrimination Act right now, does not require your employer to accommodate your pregnancy-related disability as a disability under federal law. So, for instance, if you're pregnant and you are
You need water,
or you need to sit for a few hours a day as opposed to 8 hours standing up, and you say to your employer, you know what, my physician, my OBGYN, says my ankles are swollen after 4 hours of standing. May I have a chair in order to complete, to perform the essential functions of my position? And it will not detract at all from the, it's reasonable, it's not an undue burden on the business. And the employer says, no, it's perfectly legal under federal law because the issue that you have as a temporarily so-called disabled pregnant woman is not actually a disability under the ADA, and it's not, nor is it a disability under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Unbelievable, but still, there are companies throughout the country that will say to an employee, sorry that you're only 4 months pregnant. If you can't perform the jobs right now, if your doctor says you can't lift 50 pounds, you only can lift 10 pounds, stay out until your baby's born, and then you'll first need 3 months leave, and therefore you'll be out too long, and bye-bye. The EEOC, the federal agency that administers and enforces the law, it's not law, but it does have a strong momentum sway against that. Ultimately, when the EEOC weighs in on a topic, it ultimately starts falling in line, and eventually, usually the feds ultimately bring up the rear. Although, you know, we're not holding our breath right now with this Congress. But the EEOC issued guidelines that says that, yes, a pregnant employee that is struggling with certain issues is entitled to an accommodation to continue performing the functions of her job. And again, as reasonable and as maybe as trite as it sounds, it's something that still, unless you're in a state like New York, a New York City that does provide that particular facet of the law and that accommodation, you don't get that. And there are ways around that. We've talked about in other shows in terms of bringing up gender discrimination, but
right,
it's a very important aspect. So if anybody wants to read about that more in depth, you could go to EEOC.gov. But it is important because even if it's not about the law, if you are pregnant or you're someone you love is pregnant and they're dealing with pregnancy-related challenges, and they do require their employer to be compassionate. That's the English word for reasonable accommodation. You could check out with the EEOC. Yes, Deb?
Well, I was just going to say what's really important about this ruling, since it's not a law, this ruling that the EEOC made, is that isn't this the – they're just trying to close the loophole that the intent of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was specific to protect pregnant women.
Right.
But because they didn't say – if you need a chair, that's reasonable. Because they were not crystal clear, employers have been able to use this loophole. Same thing with FMLA, or you're not entitled to a leave,
right.
That kind of a thing.
Right.
So the importance of this, I would think, is what is highlighting this loophole that needs to be closed.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know whether they call it a loophole, but I see actually it's almost tantamount to a loophole because they weren't explicit in saying that you have to do it. So, of course, the Chamber of Commerce and employers that don't want to have to be compassionate.
But the whole Pregnancy Discrimination Act is you cannot discriminate against a pregnant person.
Right.
So by not allowing her to go to the bathroom, by not allowing her to have a water bottle, by not allowing her to avoid lifting a 30-pound dog, if that's her job, or a box, that is discriminating against her.
Exactly. And by the way, the chair of the EEOC in this guidance that was just issued 2 weeks ago, it was on June 14th. That's roughly 2 weeks ago, or exactly 2 weeks ago. July 14th, I'm sorry. So it was 2 weeks ago, July 14, 2014. And she said, pregnancy is not a justification for excluding women from jobs that they are qualified to perform. And
right.
It can't be a basis for denying employment or treating women less favorably than coworkers, similar in their ability or inability to work, said EEOC Chair Jacqueline Berrien. Despite much progress, we continue to see a significant number of charges alleging pregnancy discrimination, and our investigations have revealed the persistence of overt pregnancy discrimination, as well as the emergence of more subtle discriminatory practices, as we see in our office every day, don't
right,
we?
Right, exactly. Shockingly.
Shockingly is right. And also, just lastly, among other issues, this new guidance discusses the fact that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act covers not only current pregnancy, but discrimination based on past pregnancy and a woman's potential to become pregnant, lactation as a covered pregnancy-related medical condition, the circumstances under which employers may have to provide light duty, which is what we were talking about, that doesn't exist right now, the loophole, if you will, because the Americans with Disabilities Act doesn't cover it, and the PDA's prohibition against requiring pregnant workers who are able to do their jobs to take leave. So, and they also go on to talk about best practices, which are we're not, most companies are in sort of worst to middling practices, not best. So, again, anyone who has someone in their lives they love and is working and facing some challenges regarding their pregnancy, we encourage you, beside calling our office, to take a look at the latest guidance from the EEOC, because the EEOC will accept your charge, your complaint, and process it if need be. So, that brings me to our esteemed guest, who is a good personal friend of mine, in addition to being a top-flight attorney, George Zelma. Welcome, George, to our show.
Where's the applause?
Oh, I don't have my applause. I'm sorry. I don't have the studio audience.
He usually has an applause.
I see. I wasn't. Yes,
push,
I might
push
have,
that button.
I didn't know how to get it ready for the next laugh line. I just wanted to tell everyone here, beside George, I just want to just tell everyone a little bit about your career. So George is a graduate of New York University, and he received his Juris Doctor degree from Boston University Law School. He began his career as an assistant district attorney in the county of Bronx, right?
Right.
And while maintaining his practice in commercial civil litigation, George has focused for the last 15 years on special education law, representing the families of children with special needs and impartial hearings, suspension hearings, and manifestation reviews, which you'll explain to us when we talk about that. George has participated in seminars designed to train lawyers, parents, and professionals involved in special education. He's also helped train and educate psychologists and physicians about their role in IDEA hearings. George will explain what that law is to us. And in other areas of law, George's cases have included clients who have suffered cognitive deficits as a result of traumatic or head trauma, exposure to toxic chemicals, and also medical malpractice. George is a member of the bars of New York, Arizona, California, and Washington, D.C. Fairly impressive. and also federal courts, which you didn't name here, right?
Right, right.
And a member of the New York City Education Bar Education Law Association and the Council of Parents, Advocates, and Attorneys. George has been interviewed on, beside our August program, the National Public Radio. And the thing about George, I just want to tell you, beside that he is, he's also a criminal lawyer, which we'll talk about how that practicing criminal law is inextricably interwoven with his work as an education law expert, in that one perhaps begets the other, and we should all care about that as citizens, whether or not we actually fully educate, especially these days, you know, fully educate our children, never mind our less than, let's say, fully able-bodied children. Because it will save us a lot of money in aggravation and perhaps victimization ourselves at the hands of people who don't get, you know, the help they need. So I wanted to talk with you, George, a little about that as well. But also we'll talk a little bit about how over the course of your fairly lengthy career at this point, you have always striven to take cases that are cases that perhaps other lawyers didn't consider a sure bet or a certainty or something that an underdog that just needed your expert championing. And the fact is many of them have been successful. And now when you look back and you see that, you know what, maybe you've taken cases that you shouldn't have or you might have not taken if you could do it again. But most of them you would have taken if you had to do it again, right?
I would take all of them if I had to do it all over again. Each one and each phase of my career was challenging. And I think it was a very rewarding bunch of years. I hope there's more to come. Because of doing things that were often not the more orthodox way to proceed, let's say, following things that had already been established, you know, breaking new ground felt good in certain cases, certain situations.
But was there an underlying, beside the fact that you knew that, you know, if you were successful, you might be able to turn a buck, and that's always part of what a lawyer does. If you're successful, you should benefit from your client's success. Was there a reason why in some of these cases, and we'll talk about some of them, that seemed like a stretch, and other lawyers said to you, what are you doing? Busting your chops for on this when it's so much work for such a speculative, nobody's done it before. You're taking on the U.S. Army or what have you. Was there some reason? What was the underlying impetus?
Well, that particular case that you're...
I just want to ask you, maybe you have to talk
That you're referring to was a case where American soldiers came back from Iraq and had been exposed to depleted uranium, which is... depleted uranium is the result of when shells that are made to be impenetrable and tanks that are also made to have impenetrable covering. When they collide, the material vaporizes, more or less, turns into dust, and it's radioactive on a low level. Many of the other countries pulled their troops out of those areas and certainly warned their troops about that danger. Amazingly, our government, under the administration that was in power at that time, just let these American soldiers.
Which administration?
Well, that would be the Bush administration.
Ah, the Bush W.
The same ones who didn't want to talk about Agent Orange, maybe?
Well, not exactly, but it's similar.
Right.
And it's very similar in terms of how the government acted in that situation. And... we refer to that case and trying to push our case. However, there is a thing called the Ferris Doctrine in the United States, which prohibits not only government employees but certainly soldiers from suing the United States.
Right.
However, we had a partial victory there because of a local Southern District federal judge ruled that they were, in fact, barred from bringing lawsuit while they were on active duty. But once they were not on active duty, that part of the suit was recognized. And the thing is that when they were not on active duty, when they came back home, turns out that the hospitals, VA hospitals, so all government managed, lied to them about their exposure to DU. And when they said they had all these terrible ailments because the DU affects all the organs.
What does that stand for?
Depleted uranium.
Depleted uranium.
Depleted
right.
uranium. So they were told they had PTSD or that they were just mentally not up to it, and they're hallucinating, and they're, you know, all these different reasons. Whereas in fact they did have negative toxic results from the depleted uranium exposure that they suffered from, and so. So that was a challenging case. Actually, that case came to us because of a special ed client, the lead plaintiff in the case, and had a special ed child. And then they had a child after he came back from Iraq, and that child was born with a birth deformity defect, which was clearly caused by exposure to depleted uranium.
So when you say we, by the way, I just want to, before you tell us what happened, because it's fascinating, the we was pretty much you, right?
Pretty much.
Okay. And so you're saying, so you and the defendant.
Me, myself, and I.
And the team of me, myself, and I.
No, LLP. No, actually, I had a partner on that case named Elise Langson.
Okay.
So just to say.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So you were lead counsel, I take it.
Yes, yes, I was.
And I just want to, so the defendant was. Who?
United States of America.
The United States of America. That was, I mean, was it the United States of America and then also any of the armed forces or just USA?
They may have been an army designation, but I think it was all USA. Yeah.
And was it one plaintiff or was this somehow?
No. There were many, many plaintiffs. There were about 15, 16 plaintiffs.
So you brought, this just seems like upfront a heavy lift because you knew as it was that there was already a doctrine that says soldiers can't sue.
Right.
So did you know up front, did you be able to get around that right up front because they were no longer soldiers?
No, I didn't think it would be easy to get around that, and it wasn't. But we didn't really get around certain aspects of it. I mean, how and why the government, well of course, I can understand that, you have to have some sense of order in terms of in a military situation, and being able to sue the government would maybe disrupt that sense of hierarchy and order and command. However, how a government can lie to its own citizenry about the risks that it exposes them to, and one of the most aggravating factors that I mentioned a moment ago is that other nations like Netherlands, England, I think, Germany, they pulled their troops from those areas or certainly gave them the protection. And there are ways to protect against that type of exposure.
So hundreds, thousands of soldiers perhaps were exposed to?
Well, it's very possible. I mean, we dealt with a bunch of guys here in the New York City area. And as I say, that was not a total success by any means, but at least there was some recognition.
There was a resolution, as in a settlement?
Well, there was a resolution, yeah.
Okay.
And we can't really talk
okay.
about it.
Okay. All right. But it was there was some part of it that was favorable.
Well, in the decisions, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Because these were not only our own soldiers that were some of them grievously and permanently injured, but some of their children.
Well, and the lead plaintiff's child was, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. But that's what I mean, is it still was a case that seemed like it might be a Sisyphean task and sort of a never-ending and lots of work and that you're willing to take it on anyway. And that's just something that I, as one attorney to another, just, greatly admire, especially when there was no certainty. It wasn't like you were billing by the hour.
Hardly.
That, right? Okay, hardly. So let's get now to the bread and butter of what you do, which, I think is the most, contributory, probably maybe of all the work you've done over however many decades you've been an attorney now. But
yeah,
please.
And why it's also important is the topic keeps coming up, that we have a generation of autistic, of children with challenges on a whole spectrum that, as they are becoming adults, how as society, they're just in my own family. There are a number of kids right now who, once my siblings pass, who's going to be taking care of these kids? And that as a society, we're not really set up. So, and there's more kids coming, and we're just not set up for this.
Well, yeah, and the field of science that deals with this, which is a burgeoning field right now in terms of its increasing knowledge on a year-by-year basis, is neuropsychology, which I got to say in the last 10 years there have been leaps and bounds of progress made in that field in terms of understanding how the brain functions. Obviously, you know, this country and in Europe, there are government studies now to map out how the brain functions, which directly deals with these large numbers of identifiable cases where children have learning disabilities or any number of problems that affect learning. The federal law deals with the entitlement of every student in the country to get a free and appropriate public education. The acronym is a FAPE, F-A-P-E.
Okay. So despite the fact, we all know right now, whereas, you know, I've said in the past, Thomas Jefferson, I believe, was most proud, and his one epitaph, his epitaph on his tombstone says, founder of the University of Virginia. He was more proud of founding the free educational institution than he was being the president of the United States. And he'd be turning over in his grave now if he saw what became of our higher education and the trillion-dollar, you know, loan bankster industry all around it, and the fact that half of our, if not more, of our Congress folk are trying to sort of, you know, privatize school as they're privatizing prisons and everything else. So with all this backdrop of there's no longer, CUNY used to be free, the University of California was all free, you can't now, you know, everybody, people are, private schools are $70,000 a year, some of them. So against this backdrop of how challenging it is for us, for anyone, to have access to a quality education, there is still this law known as the Individuals with Disability Education Act, IDEA, because I always still find it fascinating, and I'm sure most people don't know. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, is a law ensuring services to children with disabilities throughout the nation. IDEA governs how states and public agencies provide early intervention, special ed, and related services to more than 6.5 million eligible infants, toddlers, children, and youth with disabilities. Infants and toddlers, even with disabilities from birth to age 2, and their families receive early intervention services under another part of that law, right? Part C.
That's right.
And this I'm reading from the U.S. Department of Education's, you know, homepage about IDEA. Right. So, again, what I'm saying is what I sort of always find fascinating is in every single child, then, really, in the United States, right, that is otherwise eligible as a to be a citizen? Is that a requirement?
I don't think so.
Okay, so
anybody in a school district.
In a school district within the borders of continental United States is entitled to access, what was the acronym you just gave? The
FAPE, Free and Appropriate Public Education.
It's beautiful. It sounds like something that should be abolished soon. Free and Appropriate Public Education. And so, therefore, even if someone has really difficult problems, whether they're emotional, physical, psychological, no matter how profoundly disabled they are, the school district is charged with finding a way to educate them. And if they can't, the school district has to pay to send that child to a private school, no matter how expensive. Is that fair to say?
Well, not exactly.
Okay, so tell us about
that. No, that's pretty much right. Well, first of all, there's an article in today's New York Times which talks about a specific case that was just recently decided, and it deals with what we're talking about in terms of the costs involved, about the very great costs involved, and in that particular case for a child who had severe disabilities. So then, you know, some people might ask, well, if a child has such severe disabilities, why are we spending this kind of money?
We, the taxpayer, to
try to educate that child. The school that the parents find, that's the only reason I didn't fully agree with what you said, has to be reasonable, although that's very seldom looked at because they usually are reasonable in terms of what they provide. But I think from being an advocate for parents in these cases, I strongly believe that it's a real bang for the buck to give good education to students who need it, because in the long run, the taxpayers of this country will save a lot of money, because students who don't get what they need, sometimes they turn to criminal activity later. And often they're simply so disabled that they require all that much more care as mm-hmm. young adults. So it's important to and what the law covers in terms of what is considered to be education is not only the academic portion, but also social and emotional and life skills and all of those things that make a complete young adult human being. So if we can really address those things early in life, regardless of the cost, but the law itself is not intended to save money this year or for next month. It's really intended to give this to the citizenry of this country, because it levels the playing field, and the legislative history of the law talks about leveling the playing field, and that's the intention of the law. So in other words, it's a social entitlement piece of legislation,
right?
With it's one of the most benign and fantastic laws, because it
right.
really speaks to how our society views us, all of us. And I'm amazed, since I've been working in this field, how you can't go anywhere where, if you mention that you deal with special education, that somebody doesn't mention, oh, my son, daughter, niece, nephew,
right.
whatever, has special needs, and then then it starts that conversation.
Which is why I guess this is a good topic that might sort of bring people together in what sort of a moral issue that sort of crosses, I guess, political divides and so forth. But pushing back a little bit on that, and then I wanted to talk a little bit about the fascinating case, I think, that to make this point that you handled today. When you have one of our major political parties that still talks about how we shouldn't all have the right to health care, single-payer health care, let alone education to the for the profoundly disabled, that, as they said in that I think it was Ron Paul said in the last election in the debates, that yes, if someone doesn't have health insurance, let them die in the street. When you have all the pushback over why should we pay for what we've built and you don't have, whether it's unemployment, the welfare, minimum wage, when you talk about level the playing field in terms of, to, let's say, give someone a leg up so that they don't become criminals, maybe everyone can agree on that. But when you have, as you had today, and I think this is wonderful, you're preaching to the choir with us and our listeners mostly, but you represent, did you not, the parents of and a child who's profoundly disabled, right?
Yes.
Profoundly disabled, right? With autism spectrum.
Right.
That this child will probably not actually ever work, right?
Probably not. But you never know.
Okay, but also, just from the little bit I gathered right. from you, continue to correct me if I'm wrong, and again,
right.
I'm just pushing back to play devil's advocate. You sure. have a child who spent 10 years, roughly 10 or 11 years, right, in a public setting with supposedly some extra features thrown in, right? They were trying to
help
her.
Absolutely.
And here she is, has, what's the syndrome? The other syndrome she has for the...
Oh, PICA.
What does that stand for?
I don't know.
Okay. Is it an acronym, though?
It's an acronym,
okay.
I guess. But the symptomology of that is that she will mouth inedible items, all items, because that's how she experiences the world to some extent, or to a large extent. So, when I went to visit her once in her school, it was a rainy day. I had an umbrella in my hand, and before I knew it, that umbrella was out of my hand, and she was mouthing the handle to see what that is.
I get it. But again, that's most people, sort of a fairly significant separation from, certainly the cognitive issues, right? She doesn't maintain eye contact. She doesn't have a conversation. She's, what would you say her emotional and or intellectual development is at today?
Well, spectrum disorders are sort of funny in a way, because it can range from, the spectrum I'm talking about is the PDD autism. PDD is no longer in the DSM now, which stands for Pervasive Developmental Disorder.
Okay.
It's now replaced with autism only as the diagnosis, and on that spectrum you can have the really bright, super bright people,
okay,
and then you can have people who are not on that end of the spectrum. And then the other forms of things that the one common denominator is generally social relatedness. Mm-hmm. So from the genius end to the lower end, social relatedness is a problem. Eye contact, you know, things like that, and in terms of being able to communicate with other people,
function.
So this particular child is probably on the lower end of that. Not probably, definitely on the lower end of that spectrum. However, the difference between her getting an appropriate education, which her parents are seeking very much to get her and give her, and her not getting that is the difference between someone back in the days of Willowbrook and things like that, and then Romania and, awful scenes of people being warehoused in terrible conditions. It would be that.
I see.
Or in her case, someone who can take care of her needs, can take care of her basic physical needs, toileting, can hang up her clothes.
She can.
She can do certain things effectively. And the thing about spectrum disorders that's so peculiar is that certain things may be almost an impossible task to get over, breaking out of OCD patterns where things are compulsive disorders. But certain other things in the same person might easily be managed and done. So that's why, maybe one day she'll be able to work in a movie theater taking the tickets, not to demean that job or
exactly.
anything. But you never
right.
know what she might
right.
be capable of doing while at the same time still being
negatively affected. Helping these children, as we're speaking, but helping them become a productive member of society to whatever degree they have the ability or capacity to perform. So if taking tickets at a theater is what she could do, it would be a job, minimum wage, that she could be contributing and fulfilling some
Except
part
there's
of...
there's 1,000 people that are waiting online for that job.
I understand.
Now.
Well, no, that's true. That's true. But that's right. You know, the thing is to try to see how far we can educate any person. Now, some of us, go on to Ivy League schools just naturally. Others don't. And Congress has seen fit, which I think was a fantastic piece of legislation in
right.
this country to show where the heart and spirit of the country is.
Absolutely.
To recognize that families that have kids with learning disabilities of all sorts. I mean, it doesn't have to be autism. It could
right.
be dyslexia. It could be any number of emotional disturbance. That they get the help that they need so that, as we discussed earlier, so we can level that playing field. And as you're saying, Deborah, in terms of maybe finding that job.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we don't get to that point in certain situations, still the situation with that the facts of that person's life can be much upgraded with
right.
early intervention.
The quality
in life.
Of yeah, the quality of their life
tremendously, and therefore much less drain
yeah.
on the society.
There's no question that it is cost effective and the right thing to do on every level. And it was enacted in what, 75?
Somewhere around there. I'm not. I think
amendments
later.
Were passed in 1990, but it was originally known as the Education of Handicapped Children Act.
Right, and that was in the 70s.
Okay, but I'm saying that past post, the Reagan sort of corporate counter-revolution and everything we've seen in the last 30 some odd years. I don't know that this would have. This is not making it out of committee. This law, if it were now, so I'm saying it's a gem of a law, and I'm glad it's there. And apparently, it doesn't get the ire as a Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of the United States weighed in on this.
Oh, absolutely. Earlier you mentioned that parents, if they don't receive a free and appropriate public education, they're free to obtain those services or that school for their child. And those come from two Supreme Court cases. One is Burlington, which said that they can send their child to a school that's state-approved, and these approvals are kind of weird. It's like taxi medallions or something. And then 10 years later comes the Carter case, C-A-R-T-E-R, which said that they can send their child to a school that's not on the state-approved list as long as the parents can prove that it's an appropriate place.
And
what
year was Carter and what year was Burlington?
I think they're 84 and 94, roughly. Okay. I mean, I should know because I see them cited.
They weren't this court, and I just... They don't seem to be champing at the bit, though, do they, to, like, get it back to, like, you haven't...
Actually, when you say IDEA, it's really IDEIA because they try to water down the law about 10 years ago. So now it's technically the Individuals IDEA, Disabilities Education Improvement Act. So they try to back off really giving you what you need. They only have to sort of improve your situation a little bit.
Sounds like this court.
Yeah, that sounds like this court. But actually, the law remained largely intact. Largely.
We haven't seen circuit courts around the country like, either en masse or one at a time saying, no. Because I'll tell you what, I want you to take us through, how a bill becomes a law, how a case from like this one today, what a parent does to get help for their child with a real situation. But it's sort of by way of finishing the pushback on this. We have 1 million-plus kids in the New York City school system. Many people would say, to not distinguish in any kind of judgmental way, but even the ones that don't require specific additional help are getting a shitty education or not getting what they need, right, because of the breakdown or based on socioeconomic issues.
Right.
It's not what it used to be or what it could be. Then you take a profoundly disabled child who, let me just say, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, you have a child who, like your spectrum autism young woman today, who spent years with two caring parents, right, who spent years in the public school system, finally required, she hired you to have a hearing, right, in a local hearing with the Board of Education?
Yes.
To see if at the hearing level, whether a hearing officer would say, I am what she is getting at the local high school with all the special help, and that means this isn't 30 students in a class. That's what, 15 maybe? I mean, what did she have in the original class for 10 years?
It was a very small class, 6 to 1 to 1.
It was 6 to 1 to 1 even in the city school.
Yes.
So 6 to 1 to 1, 6 students, 1 teacher, 1 paraprofessional, public schools, right? We're all paying for a profoundly disabled child. The parents come and say, through you, and I'm on your side, I'm just pushing back. The parents come and say,
can't wait to push back.
Good, it's not enough. It's not enough. She's got pica. Yeah. She puts everything in her mouth that moves. There's all kinds of problems. There's not enough. We've got stuff hanging from the walls. There's not enough whatever. She doesn't have enough stimulation. It's not enough. We found a private place that is a small fortune that will serve her better.
Right.
And we put her there unilaterally.
Not how it happened.
Oh, okay. Well, then please start correcting me now.
Okay, so before they ever found me
or
felt that they had a need for a lawyer, this is what happened. Her pica became more acute as time went by. And in that class of 6 to 1 to 1, and don't forget, all those children have some significant needs. That's why they're there.
Right.
So she would go and maybe take something from the desk of the other students, along with everything else that she can get her hands on. Now, the other student is going to go, a little disoriented, let's say, because this girl's taking something from her desk. Now you have two students, because then you have to take that object back from our girl. So what eventually happened was they couldn't deal with it. The school couldn't deal with it.
Right.
So this is not the parent saying, I want something way better. And what ended up with this young girl, this is a few years ago now, is with her paraprofessional, which was on her IEP, Individual Education Program. So she had a one-to-one person assigned just for her. But what did they do with this young girl and this para, they put her behind a refrigerator and file cabinets, and they, in other words, she was encased in a little jail cell within the classroom so that she wouldn't interfere with the other students. So this is a clear example where the local public school system, through no ill will or anything, simply cannot meet the child's needs. Okay. And that's what Burlington and Carter deal with, is when you can't meet the child's needs.
I see.
So... And so she would come home with bruises all over her, which if that happened when she came to school, they would call ACS and report the parents. But instead, she was coming home from school with these bruises. And what a miserable plight for both her and her para to be in a space about 3 feet by 3 feet all day long. And how can you ever receive...
Where was she bruised from?
Banging against the file cabinet because she needs to move around constantly.
Okay. Right,
so she needed a program where there are no desks as such, where there are no objects that are easily reached. There happens to be an excellent school in New York that deals with severely kids with severe symptoms on the spectrum, the Rebecca School. And and she was becoming also very school-resistant. And the Department of Education realized that, so they said, we will try to find you a private school, but they couldn't find her a private school because her needs were too much for all the local private schools except for this one. So the parents looked around, and finally they found this school. Then they needed an attorney to bring a hearing request to say, please pay for this school. And so for the first 2 years, they paid for it. Then they picked on one particular year, which is the subject of the litigation right now, to say, for this year, we're not paying for it. And that has led to a bit of a calamity for this family because this was a very happy youngster in this particular mm-hmm. school.
Okay, so it's all beautiful. I mean, by the way,
and making progress. I'm sorry, I should have added
that.
Well,
that's great. Yeah. The young girl. Is
yes,
that's
absolutely
great.
Making
even
progress.
Where she is now.
Even though she couldn't, and now, well. Anyway,
so let me again. This is I love this law because it's really actually quite a socialist law. I mean, again, you're talking about sort of externalizing the cost to all of us. It's like, you know, we should all bear the cost of educating all of us.
It's a drop in the bucket in terms of the national budget.
Exactly, it's a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. So. It doesn't, but so is everything else that would make this country great again. So I'm saying it's the one thing that actually still survives that we do. Name another situation like this that we have. Perhaps you could argue that our VA hospitals would do the same thing for veterans, but they don't. This is still survives, mostly working, isn't this, by the way, IDEA or IDEIA? It mostly works.
It works. It's a fantastic law.
Okay.
It brings about only good things.
Okay, but there's, the powers that be typically push back?
Well, the Bloomberg administration hired I don't know how many attorneys to fight these cases. So they're spending, not that I begrudge fellow attorneys getting work, but they're spending all this money on all the aspects of having employees, the health benefits and all this, all the costs involved to fight parents of special needs kids instead of using that money to find appropriate programs for those kids. There's been a real there was a very dark period in special education, I would say, from roughly 2006 to close to the present time. I think it's getting a little bit better lately.
Right.
But when the
Koch brothers, are more ensconced, and if the rightward shift continues in the way it is, here was Bloomberg, a multi-billionaire person who said, I've got mine. Screw these kids. I'm going to push back and spend all the money I can to deprive these kids of a full and fair, appropriate education.
Well, so I don't know.
That's what he would describe it as.
Right.
He would describe it as
a corporate approach to education. But you can't approach it from a corporate point of view.
Exactly.
Right. Well, you can't. You shouldn't. You can't approach anything or healthcare from these are the commons. This is our commons.
Right.
Okay. So,
but for the parents, so this is the question, and as I see in my own family, parents have to hire lawyers to fight their local, to have an advocate for them, for their kids.
Well,
it isn't like how does someone without means get their kids these programs.
It ain't easy, I got to tell you, because it's a very difficult system. Parents go through a couple of phases. Initially, they're often in denial about the severity of their child's needs because everybody wants to have a healthy, happy kid. And very often parents think, oh, my kid doesn't need special ed, and they don't really see it. When they see that the child does have a need, then everybody is really on the same page, school districts and parents, and they try to do what's right for that child. When the parents come to the conclusion in those cases that the school district cannot meet that child's needs, then they become public enemy number one in the school district. It's really amazing. And parents get accused of all sorts of things, you know, that, oh, they just want their kids to go to Harvard. Crazy things, that they don't have an open mind. They're put into the position of being almost criminal defendants. You didn't really have an open mind. When did you sign the contract? You really never really gave it a fair chance, even though the parents have well-reasoned beliefs as to why their child needs a special ed program. And they started off not wanting their child to need a special ed program. Who would want it? Right. You know what I mean? Right. Initially. Anyway.
Right.
So if you don't have... I'm sorry, just to finish with everybody. Yeah. So if you don't have the money for an attorney, it's a rough go because once there's that difference of opinion between the school district and the parents... Parents are lost in the maze of that process.
Well,
totally.
You couldn't have gotten this child on the case we were talking about, which, again, I still want to get back to how it, you know, sort of what the process and procedure was. But I thought that was somewhat contingent on winning the bulk of your fees on that. No, that's not something.
Well, no, it's absolutely true. And it puts lawyers in and I think that was Bloomberg's the whole concept is that you make people go away because if lawyers chicken out because it's too steep a prospect in terms of the input of time and energy and all that, then lawyers won't be so willing to take these cases for initial retainers, let's say, but lawyers have to look for prevailing party attorney's fees. The law has what's called a fee-shifting statute. So if the parents are the prevailing party, then they can get the attorney's fees.
But that's every civil rep. I mean, we live our lives with that, and we don't have even the modest upfront retainer. So I'm saying that...
Well, very often we don't either.
So then it's not a question of if you saw a righteous case... whether they're, you know what I'm saying, they're not paying you $500 an hour. Someone who is not moneyed can get a lawyer, perhaps like you, who does this work, if a lawyer believes in it, because the lawyer can get paid if they win, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but the point is, I just know my sister and my brother, both of their kids, you know, they had to go into debt to pay a lawyer to get them into this... system and to get their kids what they needed. So that's why it's almost rigged to make it difficult. And had they not had resources,
there's no legal aid for
in New York it was even no. Well, there is, but they can't handle it. I mean, there's some agencies out there, they're advocates for children, but also the amount of money that's involved is it just makes it impossible for parents to secure the services of a lawyer in general. I mean, the hearings have been extended. They used to take like 1 or 2 days. Now they take many days. And if you're outside New York City where there are well-heeled school districts, hearings take 10 or 20 days.
Okay.
So who can afford it?
Right.
You know what I mean? And these are done just to stretch it out and just to discourage parents. And the school district attorneys will tell you that, oh, they don't want a tidal wave of cases. But there never would be a tidal wave of cases. Parents are going to do what they can do to help their children in most cases.
Right.
And it's simple as that. They're going to do that whether they have money or whether they don't have money.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And parents are already burdened with, particularly with these types of kids, all of the extra costs involved in raising these.
Oh.
Time and, you know, yeah. the child care issues. And so they're already stretched in terms of what they have to spend.
Well, yeah. And if we're dealing with autism spectrum just for the moment, I mean, there's all these other areas as
yeah.
well. But we did a documentary on that, a film a while back. And one of the things that really struck me, we did half of it here on Long Island and half of it in Budapest, Hungary, just to compare. And the one thing that was a sort of a common denominator there is that if you have a child with that level of disability, you lose all your friends, which really amazed me how that was a common theme in all these different families.
Really?
They don't want to come over. They it's really because the child is very hard to handle.
Right.
It's almost all consuming.
Right.
And I think that's why this law really, to the extent that it tries to alleviate that, it's a wonderful
yeah.
thing as a social consciousness
yes,
thing, you know,
absolutely.
On the part of society. But that's almost aside, and in addition to the actual educational factors, is that all their social connections get cut off. I was really amazed to see that. That was true here and in the city in Europe.
Well, with 6.5 million kids, as the Department of Education says, and everyone you say you speak to and someone knows someone else, the majority of them then are not able to fully use IDEA, right? Because there's like a handful of lawyers that do what you do. It's not as if they pick up the Yellow Pages.
Well, it's supposed to be a very, parent-friendly law. At the CSE level, the Committee on Special Education level, you should get your problems resolved. I mean, when you make up the annual individual education program, everything that the child needs that can be given through a school district's services should be given. However, as we're discussing, sometimes, for financial reasons mostly, in my opinion, there's litigation that ensues, and then it becomes very difficult. And when I say there were dark days, in New York has a two-tier system. There's a state review officer in Albany. And I don't exactly know what the statistics are, but there were several years around 2008, 2009, 2010 when parents, I don't think, really ever won a single case. So even if you won at the IHO level, they would appeal it, get an automatic reversal, bang, and then you'd have to go to federal court. And so right away you're dealing with major attorney's fees.
So let's go back to, again, what happened. This case, the family, the kid with PICA, so they can't handle her. They go for their local the hearing, right? The hearing officer.
They go to the Committee on Special Education,
right.
and the Committee on Special Education tells them that we can't handle your kid, but they can't find a private school. They find a private school that's not on that state-approved list. They put their child into that school, and the first year the DOE pays for it. Second year, I don't recall. I think they do pay for it. And then the third year, they say, well, we're not paying for it. You got to go to that same 6-to-1-to-1 program.
Go back to the same one.
And the federal judge, who's a wonderful judge, went to visit that program when the case finally got to him. And he saw the very things in that program. He saw a really nice school and very nice teachers. But he saw the very things in that school that the parents objected to, which the IHO understood right away, that this child would not be able to survive in that program because there are thumbtacks everywhere, there are clips on the...
It was the school itself that said we couldn't handle this kid 2 years before, right?
2 years before, the same program, same school district, New York City DOE, said we can't handle this kid. Right.
Right. How onerous it can be, the individual hearing officer who sort of conducts a little mini trial, in fact, over 5 days, over
right.
a year or so?
It was about a 4 or 5 day hearing.
Okay, over many, many months, right?
Over a couple of months.
Okay, fines for the parents,
yes.
for you and the parents, and
yep.
says, you know what, forget it. They couldn't handle her before, they're not going to be able to handle her now. Send her to this wonderful school and have the city pay. You're done.
Well, she didn't say you couldn't handle her before. She said, she was more precise, she said, From what I heard from the DOE witnesses, how they described the program, it would not meet her needs. So she was right on that school year.
Okay, so it won't meet her needs, so she should go to this Rebecca school or this wonderful private school,
right.
and the city cough up the money you were paying the last 2 years anyway.
Right.
We're done. The city says, I'm sorry, that's just too easy and too nice and too right. Let's appeal it to the state.
This is state review officer in Albany. Right?
To the state review officer who reviews it and reverses.
Right, and there was a several hundred page transcript, maybe even more than that, and it was reversed 3 weeks, nothing.
Almost automatic reversal.
Automatic reversal.
You, as the attorney, have to file a case in federal district court, right?
That's right.
So just so people know, this is the show. It's the bigs, right? It's federal court. The judge is appointed by the President of the United States.
It's with life tenure. All the corporations go there.
All the corporations go. All the big terror cases, Enron, everything is there. In fact, above the court where you file, this is just the appellate level and the Supreme Court of the United States. That's it.
That's it.
Okay, so you go into this, fancy court system before a federal court judge with life tenure, and you bring this case and say, please take a look at this. They did the wrong thing. This is the judge who happens to be a progressive who visits both schools, right? A man who's not a young man takes a day trip to these schools and says, this wasn't right, sends it back for them to do the right thing, which tells them that, right?
Sends it back to that state review officer that decided the case on the full record in like 2 weeks. And now,
said,
I want you to reconsider this case, make whatever evidentiary moves you need to make, gather more information, and decide this case not inconsistent with my decision. And he appended to his decision what he saw in these two schools.
But so it's like tantamount to a remand with directions to do it right this time.
Exactly.
Right? Okay, so but then what happens is the state review officer does nothing.
Nothing.
Sits on.
We write to them. We say, what can we do? Do you want us to actually appeal this to the Second Circuit? Can you just give us a time frame when you might decide?
Radio silence.
They write back. They say in September. They say we should have decided this back in June. And by the way, there are timelines for appealing to the Court of Appeals. So if you don't file that you want to appeal, you give up that right, then we'd be lost in limbo forever.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to at least appeal to preserve our rights. So you
file now this notice of appeal. This appeal, did you actually have to perfect that appeal?
Then we perfected that appeal with briefs this thick, and because the other side cross-appealed.
Okay,
so
George Zelman is showing us that they had like a 12-inch thick
right.
brief. Now, this is to the United States Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit, sitting in Manhattan, which is the court just below the United States Supreme Court with, how many, eight or six or judges sitting, and you argued there before them?
We argued there.
Okay,
yep.
So argued there.
Last month?
Last month. And they said, in effect, send it back to the federal court judge to grow a pair and do what he was trying to do and make the decision himself, right?
Well, something like that. They said that they had to send it back to the federal judge because the federal judge had sent it back to the SRO. It gets very complicated, so it wasn't a final order. But they say, listen, sometimes those SRO decisions are not well-reasoned, so go with the IHO decision, and they write that.
Right.
And they say, you should feel free, judge, to consider going with that original IHO decision where the parents prevailed.
Mm.
And today, you were before him again. Right?
Yes, today I was before him again today.
And you're still not, so again, and today he told you first write another legal brief.
Right. Well, that's right. This afternoon we submitted some papers, yes.
Okay.
And we're hoping for a good decision in the parents'
room. We'll be rooting for you.
Thank you.
You know, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I feel, as I had said at the start, this is going to go so much faster than you think. But so you work with trying to get kids' education, get the help and services that they require. Is there anything that you're aware of? So once a kid gets through high school and maybe a little bit of support in community college or something, is there anything that you see for these kids on the spectrum, whether it's Asperger's, autism, whatever it is, as they become adults?
We have 30 seconds, George, for that answer.
Yeah, well, all right. Sure. First of all, they're already hopefully better off because they got the services that they needed. You're asking about spectrum kids in particular, but there are many other disabilities.
Right.
There are many universities that accommodate the needs of many of the special needs that students from high school bring with them. University of Arizona in Tucson quickly comes to mind. They have an excellent program there for that sort of thing. Many universities throughout the country. And so those who can continue with higher education, yeah, can get certain accommodations on the testing, maybe whatever it might be, given that student's needs.
George, where can people reach you if they want to? Your phone number, URL, website?
Sure. Well, the phone number is 212-247-4650 in New York City. We're reconstructing our website as we speak.
So give that number again,
212-247-4650.
And ask for you or whoever, just for,
yes,
George Zelma?
Yes,
okay.
Sure.
Well, we loved having you here again. We're going to have to, this didn't do
really
it fully justice yet. We'll have to have you back.
I still have like six more questions.
You grew up in this neighborhood, right? So we're going to have you back.
Grew up in this neighborhood. And by the way, we're trying to establish a neuropsych center in Central Florida to serve the people in this rural part of Central Florida in the town of Frostproof, Florida, where this type of evaluative center would be much needed. And as I mentioned earlier, the field of neuropsychology is just a fantastic growing field and makes us better understand these learning issues.
We're hitting a hard break now. George, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you next week here on PRN.FM. Jack Tuckner, Deborah Orell with our special guest, George Zelma, signing out, telling you have a strong and powerful week. And remember, don't quit your job. Bye-bye now.